sitting in the morning sun. I'll be sitting when the evening comes.
Good morning. Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl Ingram, the Earl Ingram Show. Earl's not going to be with us today, so I am. Sam, how do people call in? What's the information they need?
Give us a call or text and join the conversation, 844-967-2789, here on 101 FM The Shaw and WAUK 540 AM.
Yeah, we just had the call in Debbie, and Debbie was pointing out, I think, a raft of problems, and I would summarize them as problems that have been created by the fact that we in the United States have seen fit not to have an adequate social safety net, the kind of things that almost every other developed country has put forth as sound policies, sort of the birthright of everyone in the country. Things like free education through all the way through college for those who can qualify, or through training school after secondary school. Things like maternity leave and early pre-education and child daycare and adequate pensions. So I'd like, for this next segment, I think I'd like to talk about the ways in which the failure of our government and our people in the policies we've adopted to provide for people have created these problems. I would describe them, you know, when a ship wrecks, the stuff that floats up on the beach is called flotsam and jetsam. And I'm afraid that a lot of the problems that we keep addressing politically are simply flotsam and jetsam. They're the damage that has been caused by the fact that we haven't had the foresight to provide for our people the things they need, the things that we should have as a matter of right as citizens in this country, things like adequate health care. If we'd had adequate health care, we wouldn't have had to deal with COVID in all of the specialized ways, all of the forgiveness of costs, the careful evaluation of how we spread the aid out amongst those healthcare providers. We would have had the government much more directly involved in it. We wouldn't have the overhang of student debt, which is clearly putting a damper on our economy and putting a damper on the ability of our next generations to participate. We have another call in.
Yes, we do. What is on your mind today?
Hi. Yeah, so I actually was wondering, and based on what you just said too, made me think that a part of the difference between us and other Western cultures in terms of education and the government and how it works is that I believe secondary schools in a lot of Western European countries end earlier in terms of the age of graduation, and that they oftentimes are already in a track of what their profession will be later in life. And I personally myself felt, in hindsight, infantilized, because I wasn't really expected to make a decision of what I wanted to do until I was already at college, or at least that's what I thought. I thought that was the normal track. And so I feel like putting some expectations on the younger generation might do some good. And I also wondered what the benefit might be of pursuing a white-collar, traditional liberal education might be these days as compared to, say, getting an apprenticeship or going for a union job, when I guess I'm even asking in terms of economically, because I'm not sure myself. I've always done trade sort of jobs, and I know that kind of experience, but I don't know what an entry-level white-collar job makes these days.
I think you've identified some problems that are societal problems as well as educational problems. I think some of those problems would be lifted by the notion that education would be available for free for people as long as they qualified for the education of their choice. And that is the case in almost all of the European developed countries. And in fact, that's the case in most of the developed countries around the world. It's not the case in the United States. There is some effort, I think, in many of the economies and societies in Europe, at least, to have people begin to focus on what they might want to, what they might want to do for a living earlier in, and they're brought, it's brought into their expectations and into their forward thinking, maybe earlier in the education process. But it would be less of a problem of for any of them, so long as education is free, as long as they want to pursue it. The problem in the United States is that we neither push people in the direction of deciding what they're going to do early, and then we also make them pay all the way along the line for whatever it is they choose to study. So if you change your mind midstream, you now have to spend a bunch of extra money to get yourself off and running in your new direction, which makes it harder to change course midstream in the process of moving through your training process. And this creates a huge problem, and it creates a lot of student debt. Student debt has become clearly, and it's recognized, I think, by people on both sides of the aisle, has become a big overhang on our economy. It's a shadow that is causing generations moving into the economy to be unable to participate in a way that will create a robust economy. People can't buy homes until they get into their 40s. Because they have to pay off their student debt through their 30s. If you can't buy a home till your 40s, you're behind the eight ball economically in terms of wealth accumulation. And so there are just lots of problems that are created by relatively minor seeming issues in our economy. We don't seem to address as a fundamentally important societal issue whether we have healthcare for free, whether we have education for free. And it's talked about as if it's a handout, when in fact what it's doing is it's burdening our capitalist economy to the point where it actually could collapse by dint of the weight of this trend towards wealth accumulation in the very few, and the societal problems and frictions that are caused by that very circumstance, as well as the circumstance of it becoming harder and harder for people to even aspire to get into that top 10%. So, you know, you've hit on some very fundamental things. And I think the main problem that creates that, however, is the unwillingness of our folks not to talk to people about what they should do for a living and to set up a different course. We have community colleges, we have Milwaukee Area Technical College and its analogy all around the country. But rather, we just charge people for it. It's laissez-faire, and it requires that people have nest eggs, either nest eggs or the capacity to take on student debt. And what have we done? We made student debt very difficult, and it's an overhang on our economy, and we're making it harder and harder and harder for middle-class families to have a nest egg, like the one Debbie mentioned, that is really necessary for people to get up and flying early in their life. So either you need a nest egg, or you need to have a social safety net that provides you the things that the nest egg would otherwise provide. And our American society has been premised on a nest egg, and yet we're taking the nest egg away from more and more people and putting a very huge nest egg in the hands of very few people. Do we have another break coming up here?
We have a couple minutes still, but I do have a text from, and you can be like these wonderful callers and texters and reach out to us at 844-967-2789. But Matt from Mount Horeb says he wants to start by saying he does not have any student loan debt and never has. But he works in a small town family-owned and operated residential remodeling company in the greater Madison area, and is certain if the younger professionals at the area had their student loans and debts forgiven, our company would have more work than we would ever have to handle. And that's just one example. And I find that to be a very great point, because how are people my age and younger going into college supposed to want to take that on if they're promised with this giant burden? You know, how are we supposed to have these skilled workers? How are we supposed to have these people fill everyone's shoes that, you know, are retiring and moving on to other things, when, first of all, we don't even get the opportunity to get in the door when we do have the degree? But when we do have the degree, we have to take whatever we can in order to start paying off that loan. You know what I mean? Like, how is there an eagerness to jump into that if I'm not promised anything anymore?
Well, absolutely, Sam. I mean, I think I think what this highlights is the fact that so much of what our politics have to talk about are band-aids to fix much more serious wounds in societal wounds that we have in our system. And I would say that this whole student debt thing is the result of the nest egg thing. Mm-hmm. And the nest egg thing is the result of a process in which we require people to pay for everything that is otherwise provided in most economies and most societies to people as a matter of right from their government. So if we have to save money to pay for health care, in today's world, to meet the standard of having health insurance in your family takes probably $15,000 minimum after tax to pay for your health insurance. If you need to save for your students' education, you undoubtedly have to save a couple of thousand dollars a year in order to have the nest egg that you could then pay for your students, your child's education when they become a college-age student going to college. If you have to pay for daycare because both parents are working, you're probably talking $15,000 to $20,000 a year to pay for daycare for your child. What does that add up to in terms of post-tax savings that need to be accrued by somebody working? And what we're talking about is $30,000 to $35,000 a year of expenses that are allocated towards things that in other countries would be provided for free. And what we're doing is we're setting our economy up for super problems. And I think the most clear-cut example of that problem is the accumulation of this huge student debt, which takes recent school graduates totally out of our economy in terms of being productive, contributing members of the economy. I think now we have a break.
Dock my home. Now I'm just gonna sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide.
Good morning, Sandy Williams, sitting in for Earl Ingram. Earl's not going to be with us today. Sam, what do the people have to do to call in?
Yeah, thanks for tuning in to the Earl Ingram Show anyway, here on 101 FM The Shaw and 540 AM WAUK. Just give us a call or a text here at 844-967-2789 to join the conversation.
So we've had some callers this morning, and I think one of the things that has really highlighted in my mind that sort of put a bee in my bonnet is this question of nest egg. Debbie, one of our callers, called in and mentioned the fact that many young students today are being sent off to college without, or going off into life without the benefit of the nest egg that many of us had. And I can remember growing up, my father telling me that the nest egg he was going to give me was he was going to pay for my education. And, you know, in retrospect, I look back on it and realize that that was the best inheritance I could possibly have had. You know, so many students today are being sent off to college to develop a negative inheritance. Their parents send them off to go to school. The school counselors help them figure out how much they can borrow in order to pay for their schooling. And they end up with a debt overhang when they graduate that's bigger than a mortgage. Not only did their parents not provide them with the nest egg to buy a house, but they're left with a negative nest egg, something they have to pay off before they can even begin to think about buying a home and entering what we would call the middle class. And so what has this done to our society, and why do we have this problem? And particularly, why do we have this problem at a time when wealth is being accumulated by a smaller and smaller percentage of the American public? And what does that portend for American society? And I just foresee that it's a very big problem. And one of the easiest ways to deal with that problem, rather than figuring out how to make sure that everyone can build up a nest egg and basically change the workings of our economy, an easier way to do this would be for us to follow the lead of all of the other developed countries in the world and to broaden the notion of what it is we owe our citizens when they're born. And most countries would believe that every citizen, when they're born, is owed the right to have adequate health care and low-cost health care, access to it. They're owed the right to child daycare and preschool education. They're owed the right to a free education and a high quality education for as long as they can qualify for education. Because what are we doing with education but simply setting ourselves up to be effective parts of the economy? And then with that healthcare through our life, we're also probably in most countries offered the opportunity to have a pension, which would be adequate for our retirement. If we had all of those things in place, we would not be talking today about forgiving student loans. Those countries don't have the problem of student loans. We would not be talking today about what it is we're going to do to solve our health problem, our healthcare problem in this country. We would not have been talking about the fundamental problems associated with healthcare that gave rise to an ugly appearance during the COVID crisis. And we would not have so many people living paycheck to paycheck on the brink of collapse economically. And we would not have people who were afraid to go to the doctor because of the expenses they would incur and who are waiting until they get really quite ill before they go to get their medical care. We've got a situation in this country which is upside down in terms of what exists in most of the developed countries of the world. And we're beginning to pay the price for that with respect to the problems that are becoming headlines in our newspaper and are dealing with a great deal of time by our legislature. We have a call in, do we, Sam?
Yes, Lee's calling from Janesville. What's on your mind, Lee?
Hi, it's Thanesville, but that's okay.
I apologize.
No
Thanesville.
Problem. Uh-huh. I've been listening, and I think, you know, it's just so terrible that the cost of education and the lack of ability to save for it is truly a huge problem. Even in, you know, people who make reasonably good salaries can't face the kind of debt that that they'd be asking for, whether they help their kids or whether they do it on their own. But what I don't hear much talk about, and Sandy, I don't know if you have any ideas, but how would our country begin to roll in any kind of paid for education? I mean, it just seems like that's overwhelming too. There's a lot of talk about erasing debts for existing students, but that would be in anticipation. I think that would be a dangerous thing in terms of people thinking, well, I'll just take out the loans and the government will take care of me at the other end of the, you know, the other end of the tunnel. So is there a way that our country could somehow begin the process of helping other than just scholarships? Or maybe that's a way, I don't know.
Well, Lee, I you know, it's a good question. I think that the problem is that we've let these things mature. We've let these problems mature to the point of becoming much more difficult to solve. If we had a culture that embraced the notion of free education, the government provided education, if we had a culture that embraced the notion of healthcare being financed at least by the government so that everyone would have access to healthcare, and if we had child daycare and maternity leave built into our system, we would have an environment that permitted people to make enough money to carry their ongoing expenses, and they would still have the ability, essentially the alternative to a nest egg, to make sure that the incoming generations had all that they needed to have an opportunity to succeed. Now, we've let many, many private universities develop, and they've developed based on a tuition level that is pretty astronomical. And will the government be willing to pay the private tuition levels that are astronomical? I think that the fact is that if we installed today the notion of the government funding education, we would find that education would be funded at the level of cost that's experienced in public education. And we would spread out the notion of, and we would broaden the amount of public education we had at the collegiate and graduate school level, and we would have to reduce the number of private universities, and that would be a wrenching financial outcome. But the only solution, I think, to this is to make college and second and post-secondary education of all kinds free or relatively free, so that we don't have the problem of immense cost that has to be borne by students. And one of the reasons it has to be borne by students is we've made it so very much harder, as you point out, for the parents of these students to save money. If you have to pay $15,000 to $20,000 a year for health care out of your own pocket, which is something that our parents didn't have to do because they all had health care provided by their employer. If you have to pay $15,000 to $20,000 for health care, and if you have to pay $15,000 a year for 10 or 12 years of child daycare, and if you have to pay for and save for your education on top of it, you need to have an income of probably $100,000 a year to get yourself ahead of your expenses so that you can actually save money going forward, because you have to buy, to be a part of the middle class, you need to own a home. So you have home ownership costs, and you just have to do the math. And I'm afraid that most of our politicians must earn so much money that they don't understand what paycheck to paycheck feels like. And that people who are earning $100,000 or less a year and have two or three children and are looking to the future, those people are living paycheck to paycheck. And their capacity to pay for an expensive education for their child is about nil. And so, I think the problem is that the politicians of this country have to stand back and they have to look at what's going on, and they better nip this problem in the bud, because I believe that it has the potential to tear society apart. I think we have another break. That's not a very lofty, hopeful kind of a break a point, but that's where we're at. Good morning. Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl Ingram. Earl won't be with us today. We're talking about a variety of issues. Right now, we're sort of zeroing in on economic issues that face the incoming generations into our economy. Sam, what do people have to do to call in?
If you have any ideas on the topic or any other topic, give us a call or text here at 844-967-2789 and join in on the Earl Ingram Show here on 101 FM The Shaw, as well as 540 AM WAUK.
So, Sam, during the break, I decided to do some math. We've been talking about sort of the eight ball that people are behind when they enter the economy today with student debt. Mm-hmm. And one of the points that was made by one of the callers was the fact that people don't have a nest egg that's essentially inherited from their parents that would pay for their education, at least, so they're left with this debt. And then we've talked about the problems created by the current costs associated with healthcare and other things. So I decided to do some math, and I decided that I would take an income of $100,000. I think most callers would say that $100,000 was plenty of income that would take you well into the middle class and should provide you with the opportunity to care for your family and maybe even pay for their education. And then I decided to figure out what are the expenses that someone with $100,000 income might face. So let's say that the couple earns $100,000. And let's assume they pay taxes of $25,000 on that $100,000, which is probably a modest amount of taxes, because that's probably the income tax level and probably doesn't include the property tax level that they would pay. And then let's say that they have three children and they have to buy health care insurance for their family because their $100,000 comes from a small company that they operate, and they have to buy their own health insurance. And their health insurance for the family, and I think this is a modest number too, is $15,000 a year. And let's say that these three children have a period of about 8 years spread amongst them, and the couple works together in their business, so they need child daycare. And their child daycare costs are $15,000 a year, and they need about 10 years of that. So let's just say that for the first 10 years of their marriage, they're also spending $15,000 a year on healthcare. And then they've got additional costs on top of that. They need to save for their retirement, and they've been told by their counselor that they probably should save at least 4% of their income a year for retirement. So they have $4,000 a year to put aside for retirement, which incidentally isn't probably going to give them a very very fat retirement level if they save that every year, and even if it's invested relatively soundly. So now they've got $34,000 that they've spent on just those kind of basic things, taken from the $75,000 net. Now they have $41,000 left, and they haven't paid their rent or they haven't bought their house yet. So let's just assume that $2,000 a month is a pretty modest amount for them to spend for housing for their family with three children. In fact, it's probably not enough. They probably should be spending $2,500 a month. $2,500 a month is way below the percentage of expenditure of disposable income that's recommended for them. So we could even go to $3,000 a month as a much more reasonable number. That's $36,000 they pay for housing. But they only have $41,000 of the disposable income left after they've made these expenditures. So now they have $5,000 a year left to buy groceries, to pay their utility bills, and to otherwise take care of their family. How do you think that's going to go, Sam? Does that sound like paycheck to paycheck to you?
You know, this person doesn't even exist, and I have anxiety for them. It doesn't work.
It doesn't work. $100,000 a year doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is they have $15,000 a year to pay for health insurance. They have $15,000 a year to pay for daycare. And they've got other expenses that they face of $4,000 for retirement because they aren't going to get any adequate retirement any other way. And so we've put on a burden on families to the point where our notion of what it takes to be in the middle class isn't $100,000. It's undoubtedly at least $150,000. And $150,000, if we did the math again, you would see that it leaves that family very little money to, for instance, save for the education of their children. I didn't add into that number the amount of student loan repayments that a young family would have to pay today. And I don't know, if someone had a student loans of $40,000 a year, Sam, would that be pretty normal? $40,000, I mean, total? Of student loans, huh?
Because I've been out so long, I don't even remember. Yeah. I also chose smartly. I was smart and I chose the cheapest UW out there. So I don't even want to speak on that because mine's probably on the low ball.
Well, I think the average student loan is a double digit number that's probably closer to $40,000. And so the annual repayment number for that and the monthly repayment cost for that, I'm not experienced with student loans, but it comes out of this number as well. And I think if politicians and those who are making policy in this country, and if the conservatives who are interested in laissez-faire processes and having everyone kind of caveat emptor pay for themselves, if they did this math, they would quickly realize that the burden we're placing on families associated with what is called the social safety net is putting our families behind an eight ball that is going to drive a wedge into society and is going to create a very significant problem in the United States, a problem that is not faced by almost every other developed country, including our developed country immediately to our north, spelled with a C called Canada. Our neighbor Canada has a far different set of policies associated with all of these things, and it creates a far different environment in terms of the capacity of young people to move into the economy in a satisfactory way, even with a lower wage scale. You know, if we removed these expenses from people's outlook, that $100,000 would become a comfortable income, such that society and industry would not have to think about paying a substantially higher wage and still have people satisfied, families that can have vacations, families that can educate their children, families that can provide health care without the fear of their child developing tonsillitis and taking them to the doctor and experiencing a health care cost the family can't afford. Because incidentally, a $15,000 a year family policy probably carries a pretty big copay, so that those first visits to the hospital, the first visits to the doctor are still pretty expensive and pretty off-putting for a family that's living paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah, I think that that's insane. And I have a text from Kay from Milwaukee here that goes hand in hand with another recent issue being brought up with the Supreme Court potentially overthrowing Roe v. Wade. So thanks so much for texting this in. They say, so let's cut abortion rights for women because they can't afford kids due to student loans and expensive health care. In the U.S., the average cost for a vaginal birth is $13,024, including standard pre-delivery and post-delivery expenses, such as facility fees and doctor fees. A cesarean section is much more expensive, which, again, you don't get to choose that. Sometimes that's just necessary. And it costs an average of $22,646, including standard pre-delivery and post-delivery expenses as of February 28th, 2020. Thanks again for texting that in, Kay, and you can be just like them and text us or call us at 844-967-2789.
Well, Kay, you know, that's another issue, and it leads to some more math. You know, I wonder whether our policymakers and whether the people who are championing the notion that socialism is a terrible danger and that somehow providing government paid for health care, like, for instance, Medicare for All, something that all of us who are older than 62 both enjoy and worship at the throne of, right? I mean, the question of health care for all of us older than 62 is a non-existent problem. Is this question of health care and income? If the health care costs are $15,000 to $20,000 for a family to get adequate health care insurance, and probably takes $20,000 a year to get one that doesn't have a material copay, that means that there are people who are living at the margin of income who have to decide whether they want to go out and hustle to find a higher paid job and lose their qualification for instance, in Wisconsin Badger Care, and how much added income do they need to get in order to be the incentive to get off of Badger Care, because many people who have the fear of healthcare costs are receiving Badger Care because they are low income, but they would have to go out and get a job that would pay them maybe $30,000 a year more than they're currently earning in order to be the incentive they need to get out from under this fear of healthcare that is driving them to live on the edge of poverty so that they can qualify for Badger Care. And I think people who say that this is an incentive for a handout are looking at the tea leaves upside down and backwards. What they don't understand is that there's a huge portion of our population, those who live paycheck to paycheck, who have decided as a matter of financial triage that they are not going to pay $20,000 a year for healthcare. They're going to roll the dice to see whether they have this year the healthcare problem, because it's a matter of probabilities. And they're going to do that because they can't afford all of the other necessities of life that are required in order to meet the needs of their families. Healthcare is something which is a potential massive expense, but the operative word there is potential. And so people roll the dice with it because they have to. And the notion that they should simply run out and buy healthcare without, in fact, improving their income by a very material amount is asking people to step backwards, materially backwards, and into the brink of insolvency on a month-to-month basis. So I just don't think people do math. I think the people who are looking at this problem are not doing math as if they're a family, looking at what a family's costs are. And I don't know why the Democratic Party and the Republican Party don't put on a bit of financial education for the country so we could have a blackboard up in front of the public when we talk about any of these issues to point out what it does to Tom, Dick, and Mary. Because to me, this is a pure math problem, and it's simple. And it's simple to see what the problem in the family income disparity is. And the problem is this social safety net. And without solving it, I would say that our business leaders are risking the golden goose. They're putting the golden goose at risk for fear that they might have an inflated tax rate, which incidentally, most of which would be compensated for by the services they themselves would receive in terms of healthcare. I think we have a break coming up again, so let's go. This morning is the Earl Ingram Show. Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl Ingram. Earl won't be with us today. Sam, how do people call in?
Yeah, Earl's not here, but we sure are glad you are tuning in here on 101 FM The Shaw, as well as WAUK 540 AM. Give us a call or a text and join us in the conversation at 844-967-2789.
You know, before the break, we were doing the math, the family household math, sort of a civics finance lesson. And thinking about it some more, you know, we assumed a family earning $100,000 would pay $25,000 of taxes. And we went through the math, and it revealed that if they had to pay $15,000 a year, which is probably at the low end for health insurance, and $15,000 a year for daycare, they were, when you got done with all of this, they were left with about $5,000 for groceries. And if we assume that now let's look at the flip side of this. Let's say that we have Medicare for all. Let's say that Medicare for all meant that everyone's taxes were going to go up 15%. Not that the tax rate would go up 15%, but the taxes they pay would go up 15% in order to cover that cost. And if we assume that there was a flat tax, then the 15% increase on that $25,000 a year would be about $3,750 of additional taxes. So let's just say that their tax rate goes up to $30,000 a year, but in exchange for that, they don't have to pay the $15,000 a year for health insurance. So the family of $100,000 gets a $10,000 benefit, even with the tax increase that's associated with Medicare for all. Now, if you earned $300,000 a year and your tax rate went up 15% from what it was, and let's say that at $300,000 a year, your tax rate you were paying was $50,000 a year, then your tax rate is going to go up 15% on that, which is still only $7,500, and you're saving money again against your health care insurance. So I don't know whether that math is absolutely accurate, but I can tell you that the outcome of that is that you have to be a very high income earner before you are worse off on a net cost basis by avoiding the payment of your private health insurance because of Medicare for all. The people who earn a very large sum of money a year will be worse off in terms of their tax rate, but the general public will have access to health care, and the economy should be so improved by this underlying benefit that it's probably true that everyone in the economy would be better off as a result of this. And I think we could do the same kind of analysis for education and education cost savings to realize that the general economy would be better off with that kind of analysis too, that kind of program. So, you know, the European countries that installed these policies based on the values and cultural values in those countries had a great deal of foresight, because what they've installed has created a very vibrant basis for an economy, because it's allowed the people in those economies to, and the families in those economies, to cover all of their family requirements, and the birthright for everyone coming into that economy without creating the kind of political problems and social problems that we've created in the United States. How are we going to move from where we are today to where we need to get? And can we get there with the impediment of a culture and a society which seems to be not very aimed at solving the family problems of the next generation? So to me, if we could have a political process which was dedicated to formulating policies that would create the birthright in this country that exists in so many other developed countries in the world, that would allow families to live fearlessly in the economy without the overhang of student debt, without the fear of going to the doctor and becoming insolvent and bankrupt, and with the notion that they could have an adequate retirement without kind of the fear of growing old. We have a general fear in this country of growing old. And what are the two reasons for that? Well, when we get old, we get sick. And when we get old, we need to retire. And both of those things are fearful objects. Now, in the United States, we have solved for the getting old and sick problem for those who are 62 and over. Apparently, if you can make it to age 62, we're going to take care of you. If you can't make it to age 62, it's caveat emptor. So you know, maybe that's enough about the family problems, but I think quite frankly that everything ties together. And the next thing we can talk about, which is the war in Ukraine, comes back, those chickens come home to roost in this, in the area of family issues and financial issues, because the more we spend on our defense, the less able we are to spend money on education for our young and for healthcare, because we find that those in Washington who are willing to open their checkbooks and quickly approve in the neighborhood of $50 billion to solve an international problem that is identified in Ukraine are unwilling even to have a debate to talk about spending a far lesser sum of money for instance, child daycare. And why is that? Why do we not put a higher premium on the child's birthright, the next generation's birthright in this country, than we put on the United States being involved with and being financially covered on the concept of being able to be involved in wars in three different fronts, to have an expenditure for defense that is three times the level of most other countries? We spend about 2.5 to 3 times the dollars per capita of our GDP than other countries in the world. I think one of the only countries in the world that exceeds us is Russia. And one of the reasons they exceed us is their GDP per capita is so much smaller than ours. We have by far the highest GDP, gross domestic product per person in the world, as compared to Russia, which is 11th. Actually, our GDP is the highest in the world. Our GDP per capita, I think, is 4th, because we aren't the most prosperous country in the world, in spite of what we tell ourselves. I believe that there are Norway and several other countries that are more prosperous per capita, but our total GDP is much, much greater than any other in the world. And the country which exceeds us in the GDP per capita that they spend on military, the only one that is Russia. So, and China's far below us, and many other countries are far below us. So, what's wrong with our priorities, and how will we societally and how will we politically get our priorities shifted so that we can look first and foremost at the birthright of our children? How are we improving the birthright of our children by expending $50 billion in Ukraine and not expending money on child daycare, healthcare for the young, healthcare for everybody, and free education to get our kids started in a manner that doesn't leave them behind the eight ball? And to me, the danger and the problem we have politically and societally is nobody makes these comparisons. Nobody stands up and says, should we spend this money for defense? Because we can't, if we spend it there, we can't spend it on the next generation. We can't spend it on the birthright of our citizens. And if that's the choice we're making, if it is in fact the choice we're making, then the people ought to do it with their eyes open. And if they decide with their eyes open that we need to spend it on defense rather than the next generation, well, that's what the people decided. But we aren't thinking that way, and the people aren't deciding that way. And so my question to the listeners is, how do we get our public, how do we all begin to think that way? How do we get our politicians to think that way? And isn't it our fault as people that we have allowed our politicians to listen to the interest groups who operate in the dark in Washington, who run around and persuade our elected representatives that they ought to cast their votes in favor of spending money on defense that therefore can't be spent on our children and on our families and on the welfare of our next generation? I think we have another break. They seem to come rapidly, or maybe time flies when I'm talking. Anyway, on to a break.